Father in heaven, we do thank you that we can be again together this afternoon. Thank you for some respite from the rain, as well as some opportunity to seek you and your faith. Please help us to see you through the counsel you've given us on healthful living. Help us better appreciate how to care for our bodies and minister to those around us. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, as you see illustrated here, when we left off our series this time yesterday, we were speaking about how to naturally boost levels of brain-derived neurotrophic factor, commonly referred to as simply BDNF. And many of you got so excited about dietary restriction that there was extra food in the cafeteria. And maybe you saved some money, too. Well, maybe you didn't get that excited just yet. I was eating breakfast in the cafeteria. My plate did not look like this, nor did I notice anyone else's. We're not saying you have to be this extreme, was the point of this illustration. I told you that the research indicates not only does BDNF rise with caloric restriction, but so does longevity. There's a correlation between living longer and actually eating less. Well, we had covered a number of these things, including the fact that by eating less, you actually boost your likelihood of being more effective in dealing with inflammation. So if you have arthritic conditions or musculoskeletal problems, if you cut back on your dietary intake, this can help you. And, of course, I've told some of you who've been with me from the beginning of the week that one of the things I've done a lot with, as well as some of my Adventist peers in lifestyle centers, is put people on fasting programs, usually for 3 to 5 days, and many times a host of things like high blood pressure, diabetes, arthritis can improve dramatically. This is just some of the background for it. Well, now we're on to some new material. Some of you were very anxious to learn about this, Alzheimer's disease. This is just some fascinating summary statements very recently, back in 2007. This is a group that is especially working on dementia. They're called the Neuroinflammation Research Laboratory there at Mount Sinai School of Medicine. Someone was just telling me, I just had a radio guest from Mount Sinai, and I think they told me that they've changed their name. But we're so far from New York City that probably none of you know what they changed their name to. And I guess I haven't reviewed my brain health material enough to have my memory good enough to remember what it was. But anyway, it's now widely accepted. Here's their statement. Now widely accepted that if the onset of the disease, they're speaking of Alzheimer's disease, could be delayed by even 5 years, the incidence could be cut in half. Now, let me tell you what they're speaking about here. Yesterday, we talked about compression of morbidity. Do you remember that? If you could just stave off illness, if you couldn't prevent it, if you could stave off an illness or a problem to late in life, it would minimize its impact on you. Well, these researchers are going a step further. They're saying if you could delay the onset of a disease long enough, you would die from something else before it ever came knocking on your door. Do you see the picture? In fact, when do people typically get Alzheimer's disease? It's late in life. So, if you were destined to come down with Alzheimer's at 90 and die at 95, if you could just delay that Alzheimer's by 5 years, you'd never experience it. Do you see how that works? That's what they're talking about. And they're saying we would cut our Alzheimer's cases in the U.S. in half if we could just delay the onset. So they're going to talk now about what you can do to delay the onset of Alzheimer's. Here's how they put it. Both clinical and epidemiologic evidence suggests that modification of lifestyle factors such as nutrition may prove crucial to Alzheimer's disease management, given the mounting experimental evidence suggesting that brain cells are remarkably responsive to what somebody is doing. Well, what does that mean in plain English? By the way, I should show this to my boys. Sometimes we're reading the Spirit of Prophecy together. As a family, we've been going through the book Prophets and Kings. They marvel at how long some of those sentences are. But we do it today, too, in some of these medical papers. What they're saying is there's two big sources of medical information. One is what we call epidemiologic data or epidemiologic evidence. That is the science that looks at what happens to groups of people. That's what it literally means. Epi is a pond, from the Greek, referring to a pond. Demos refers to people. Ology is the study. So literally, it's the study of that which comes upon people. So epidemiology, it's the science where we look at groups of people, and we look for relationships between things like lifestyle and exposures and disease rates. That's epidemiology, looking at free-living people and what happens to them. Clinical evidence is where we actually do studies. That's where we do trials, where we give one group one thing and another group gets a placebo. Do you understand? So they're saying the two big streams of research, evidence, both concur that lifestyle can help us stave off Alzheimer's, and especially nutrition. Well, what is it about nutrition? Well, the researchers were not silent. Let's see what they have to say. Recent studies strongly support the evidence that caloric intake may play a role in the relative risk for Alzheimer's disease clinical dementia. So what they're saying is higher caloric intake increases the risk of Alzheimer's disease. Specifically, what they found is high caloric intake of saturated fat tends to feed Alzheimer's disease. This is a term for the technical type of changes that occur in the Alzheimer brain. Well, where do you find saturated fat? Primarily animal products. Okay? So you thought you could eat all the meat you wanted because your cholesterol is just perfect. No. If you're interested in optimal brain health, you want to take the meat and the milk and the cheese off the diet, especially the whole milk. You say, well, I just need skim milk. I don't get much saturated fat. Well, there's other concerns with that, but it's not a source of saturated fat. They didn't stop there, though. Even restricting carbohydrate intake is able to prevent it. Now, this we're speaking in relative terms, or I should say absolute terms. In other words, you've got to eat something. You can't decrease your intake of protein, fat, and carbohydrate. But if you're overeating on carbohydrate, in other words, you can't say, well, Dr. DeRose, I'm a vegan. That's why I had the 5 pieces of cake after lunch. Okay? It was vegan cake. Yeah, no, this is not the solution either. So when we curb our intake of calories, we decrease inflammation in the body, and we decrease our risk of neurodegenerative diseases. Now look at this. This is a shocking statistic when you realize that the American population is getting progressively heavier. Obesity and diabetes together combine to increase the risk of Alzheimer's disease over fourfold. Over fourfold. You know, it's interesting to me, some of you have been talking with me about different health issues, different health concerns that you have. And some of you have talked with me about this dynamic of how do you know how serious to get about your lifestyle? After all, many of you are doing pretty well. You came here to camp meeting, right? I didn't see anyone who had to be, you know, brought in here on a stretcher or a gurney. So, you know, you're doing pretty well. So how serious should you be about making lifestyle changes? How many of you think if you really, you shouldn't get too worried about your mental faculties until you're actually diagnosed with dementia? No, you say, this is crazy. This is absolutely crazy. I actually had some physicians say to me once, I remember the discussion was some years ago, they said, Dr. DeRose, you know, what some of you are talking about, you know, this very extreme lifestyle, it's fine if someone's really sick. But, you know, it's not necessary for most people. But I couldn't help but think about it. I mean, do you want to wait till you get really sick before you have to make changes in your lifestyle? And by the way, Some of you have told me, you heard me speak here a few years ago, and you even have my DVD, Changing Bad Habits for Good. The whole point of that presentation that I gave at camp meeting, and we still have it available here in the bookstore, special for you, is that we can develop new enjoyment. You can develop an enjoyment for a totally different lifestyle. So don't set the bar as low as you can. Say, look, I'm doing pretty well right now. I bet I could do better. Why don't I follow the very best lifestyle? And if you haven't heard me this week, I've told you hopefully enough about my background that you realize that I was frequenting the fast food restaurants and eating the junk food and every night not going to bed before I had a sweet snack. I didn't know anything about the health methods. I never heard of the Seventh-day Adventist Church growing up. But I didn't tell you, in full disclosure, I have to tell you, I did have one good health habit. And that was I always ate breakfast. How many of you are impressed? I vividly remember, I went to took a bus to go to high school. And when I got off that bus, I'd go right to the cafeteria and get a candy bar and a Coke every morning. Really, I'm just telling you. So if some of you are dealing with some lifestyle issues, I mean, I've been there with you. I'm not somebody who, you know, was following some extreme diet all my life, and I don't think the diet I'm on now is extreme. In fact, if you look at people who are just eating a plant-based diet, they often have more variety in their diet than the average American. So I don't feel deprived at all. I mean, at first I missed all that stuff that I was eating, but your body, if you make a change and stick with it, develops new enjoyment. If you don't believe that, get the DVD, Changing Bad Habits for Good. Make some changes. Follow some of those principles, and you'll be surprised. So I take that time to tell you this in this context because we're not talking about choosing between a happy life with Alzheimer's or a miserable life without it. You understand my point? You can have a high-quality life, and you can avoid these diseases. This is a real photograph. Apparently, I think these were a couple of people in Barnum Bailey's circus. So I've shared this with you, and some of you have still been talking with me about this. It's this powerful weight control weapon. It's eating to satisfy hunger, not eating to try to satisfy appetite. And I gathered that some of you wanted me to talk a little bit more about this. I'm not going to go into great detail, but let me tell you just a bit more. When we're infants, we know when our hunger is satisfied and we stop eating. But in American culture, we educate ourselves to eat when we're not hungry. So you go to your friend's house. You just ate. You're 8 years old. You go over to your friend's house. I know I did. And what did my friend's mom offer me? Something to eat. And what did I do? I ate it. Probably because it tasted good, whether I was hungry or full or not. And so, what happens if you skinned your knee? I mean, maybe you had a mother who just kissed it and put a Band-Aid on it. But in some homes, you'd get some food to make it better. Or you had a hard day at school. What would you get? Some of you remember you came to the Ancient Secrets Modern Health series, and we told you if you were an Egyptian child when you came home, what did your mother give you? That's right, beer and bread. Beer and bread. So this, what I'm just saying is through across cultural lines, I'm not saying every culture, but especially here in North America as well as in other places in the world, it's just expected that certain times people feed you. And so we start to learn to eat when we're not hungry. And so many of us lose touch with when our hunger is satisfied. Now, what's the difference between hunger and appetite? Well, hunger is a true physiologic need for food that your body senses. Appetite is the desire for food that may or may not be in keeping with hunger. May or may not be. So I had a good appetite before I went to lunch today. I was hungry. I hadn't eaten since breakfast. And I had a good meal. And one of you here, I'll mention no name, contributed to my meal by sharing a special healthy dessert with me. Wasn't that nice? By the way, any of you can do that. I'm not a huge dessert eater, so if you want to, you know, share something else with me, you can.
By the way, I don't expect that from anyone.
But the point I'm simply making is that's the time to give someone something to eat. It's the meal. You following along? But in our culture, we eat between meals. And we lose sense of this. Let me tell you some things that will help you tell the difference between hunger and appetite. If you're thinking about this at your next meal, some of you already have determined to skip supper because you're figuring ways to cut your caloric intake and maybe you want to trim down a little bit. So tomorrow morning at breakfast time, you're eating breakfast and you say, I wonder if I'm still hungry. Well, if you start asking that question, you know what the best thing to do is? It's just stop eating. Well, wait! If I stop eating, what happens if it was hunger and not just merely appetite? I might not have gotten enough to eat. You realize, you may not realize it, but many of us on a certain level are afraid that we're not going to eat enough at a given meal. Are you aware of this? I know it sounds crazy, but it's true. Many of my overweight patients over the years, they have this fear that they're not going to get enough to eat at a given meal. What happens if you didn't eat enough at breakfast? How many of you think there'll be an opportunity to eat at lunch? Yes? I mean, we're not living in a refugee camp that has sporadic, you know, food delivery. Okay? Basically, if you made a mistake and you still were really hungry and you left, you might get hungry at 11 for lunch instead of 12, and you'll have to go a whole hour before you can eat. But do you see what I'm trying to explain to you? I have patients that fast for 3, 4, 5 days. How many do you think we've lost? That's probably colleagues and I and institutions I've worked in. We've probably fasted hundreds of people over the years. How many fatalities do you think we've had? You have great confidence in us. You really think we've had zero fatalities? Yeah, I've never had a patient die during a fast. Never. Well, so why are we so worried? What do you think is going to happen? Now, sure, if you're taking if you have diabetes, you're taking insulin or Glyburide or Glipizide or one of these medications that lower normal sugar, well, you can't just, you know, you need to get enough calories if you're taking those kind of medications and not adjusting it. You understand what I'm saying? But for most of us, no big deal. So that's the first key. If you've got a question, then just quit. Well, let me tell you another one. We call it the substitution test. And sometimes I'll tell a story that goes along with this, but well, I'm trying to strike a balance. You know, some of you have heard some of my stories before. And it's kind of a memorable one. I'll tell you anyway. It happened to my wife many years ago. Actually, before she was my wife. She was very health conscious. And so she was eating at someone's home, and it was time for dessert. And so I know that because in this story, she ends up eating the dessert. It was a very healthy dessert. So she's sitting there with the hostess, and the hostess's two children, a girl and a boy, young children. Everyone has finished except her young son, the hostess's son. What do you do if you're the hostess? You've got dessert, everyone's finished the main meal, except for Johnny, who's still got food on his plate. What is proper etiquette? Do you even know? You wait on Johnny? Stay with him? Okay. Well, maybe it was poor etiquette, but she decides to bring out the dessert. And so she brings out the dessert, and she gives a cookie to my wife, to her daughter, and she takes one for herself. How do you think Johnny's doing? Mommy, could I have a cookie too? No, Johnny, not until you finish your celery. But Mommy, I don't have any room. If you don't have room for the celery, you don't have room for a cookie. But Mommy, I don't have a long space in my stomach for the celery, but I got a round space for the cookie. I tell that story because it illustrates something about appetite. Appetite tends to desire specific things. Whereas if we're hungry, we'll eat anything that's acceptable. So let's say you're in the cafeteria today, and you came in kind of late like me, and they brought out that lentil loaf, okay? So you have a serving of the lentil loaf, and you eat that, and you say, boy, that's really good, I'm going to go up for second. And so you go up for second, you say, boy, that was really good, I'm really hungry.
It's not appetite. I'm going to get third. You know, some of the people at the table are, you know, starting to kind of look at you. And then you're getting up for four. And they say, didn't you hear Dr. DeRosa's lecture about hunger and appetite? I said, no, that's coming up in the next hour. Well, let's say it happened already. Okay? Haven't you heard Dr. DeRosa's lecture? And they say, this is hunger. Do you realize how hard I've been working at camp meeting? I mean, I walk between the dorm and the chapel and the dining room and I listen to all these stimulating lectures. This is hunger. It's not appetite. Well, here's what you can do. It sounds too austere just to stop when you have the question or when someone else asks you the question. As you're going up for that fourth serving of lentil roast, and you see the celery there on the salad bar, ask yourself the question. If there was no lentil loaf, would I take some celery? Now, I mean, I'm assuming you're not allergic to celery and it tastes okay to you. If you're hungry, what would you say? Well, if that's all that's left, what would I eat? I eat the celery. You say, no, but I'm not hungry for the celery. I'm hungry for the lentil roast. Well, how about the tomato? They have some really nice cherry tomatoes there. And you look at those tomatoes. You like tomatoes. And you say, would I eat these tomatoes? No, I'm not hungry for them. I'm hungry for the lentil roast. You see what's going on here? Appetite calls for specific things. So the idea of the substitution test is, say, if I'm really hungry, I'd be willing to eat the celery, the tomatoes. By the way, if you say, yes, I'd eat the celery if that's all that's there, I'd eat the tomato, well, then go ahead and have the fourth serving of the lentil roast. You don't have to choose something you don't like as well. Do you understand my point? There may be other considerations in that, but you understand my point. You say, well, okay, so you're giving me some things to work with. Let me tell you a few other things that will help you to differentiate between hunger and thirst. Oh, that's the point. Between hunger and appetite. Thirst. If you're thirsty when you sit down to eat, you're much more likely to overeat. Are you aware of that? The brain has great difficulty differentiating between hunger and thirst. So make sure you're well hydrated between meals, so when you sit down to eat, you'll be more in touch with whether your hunger is satisfied or not. By the way, if you're eating quickly, you're eating rapidly, you will not tend to be in tune with when hunger is satisfied. Prime setting for overeating is just seeing how quickly you can eat, or seeing like you only have 10 minutes for lunch. You with me? So make sure you have adequate time, you're less likely to overeat, and you'll be more likely to be in tune with when your hunger is satisfied. We won't ask you to guess who you think did a better job controlling their appetite, because you can't tell by looking. You might think you can tell. She could be very careful in her eating habits and just be very genetically predisposed to weight gain, and he could be a glutton. You can't tell by looking at someone. Okay? So we talked about this, slowing your eating, if there's a question, quitting, and for the less brave, the substitution test. So what about periodic fasting? If you're going to skip a meal, which would be the meal not to skip? That's right. Isn't it interesting? Sometimes I'll tell people, you know, there's some evidence that two meals a day are better than eating three, and they'll say, well, I always skip breakfast. No, this is not the meal to skip. Actually, we're speaking about longevity and cognitive performance. The evidence actually suggests that eating breakfast is associated with longevity. This is data from the Alameda County study, the famous study from there in the Bay Area of California. And what they found in that original data is that men who ate breakfast and didn't eat between meals had less than half the risk of death of men who skipped breakfast and snack. I mean, just conceptually, this is not difficult. Now, it may be difficult to develop new habits. Like I told you, even though when I was growing up, I ate breakfast, wasn't necessarily a good breakfast, I was also snacking all the time. So, but you know what? Between meals now, do you think I get hungry? No, I'm not looking for food. Your body gets used to what you do. This is a study that looked at 60 to 94-year-olds. Actually, it's the same study. They followed these people over time. And they found something very interesting. Those who didn't eat breakfast regularly had a 50% increased risk of death compared to the regular breakfast eating. And if you skipped breakfast in this older population, they were actually as bad off as far as their likelihood of going to an early grave as the smokers and those who didn't exercise. Are you following along with me? So you say, well, I don't smoke, Dr. DeRose, but if you don't eat breakfast, you might as well just be a smoker. Well, I don't know that I'd go that far. But as far as longevity, do you know why it actually, by the way, it actually changes when you get older. Most people don't take up smoking in their 60s. Are you aware of that? So if someone's a smoker and they're alive in their 60s, it already shows that they're relatively protected from the worst complications of smoking. The worst complications kill you early. I mean, I've had patients in their 20s who died from heart disease from smoking. I remember a patient I had in his early 30s died from lung cancer. His only risk factor was smoking. So those people never got to their 60s. If you live in your 60s, smoking proportionately is a less risky behavior. But let me tell you this. It's still a very risky behavior. And it's going to still cut your life short. It's going to still increase your risk of what? In the mental health arena. Dementia. We showed you that data. So I had a grandmother who was 65, finally decided she would quit smoking. She ended up living to 95. I mean, what would happen if she hadn't quit? And her mental faculties seemed generally well preserved. I don't think she would have reached that age and done as well as she did if she had kept smoking. The point is, it's never too late to quit, but realize there's other things that are also very important as far as longevity and mental quality. Well, let's talk just a little bit more about things to boost BDNF, so important for brain health it is. Regular physical exercise. You've heard about that before in these lectures. I'll just be honest with you. There's almost nothing you can talk about in preventive medicine and avoid the topic of exercise. So if you needed any more reason to do physical activity, how often? Every day. It's right here. I'll tell you the truth. I'm going to just be honest with you. I got on a regular exercise program, when I was living here in Minnesota. Around the same time that the Lord was getting my attention about other things, and I ultimately became a Seventh-day Adventist. And I learned about the Sabbath. So what do you think, being a young Adventist, learning about the Sabbath, what do you think I thought I should do on the Sabbath? That's right, I should rest. And, you know, I should go to church and sit in meetings all day. And after a while, I noticed something. The day I felt the worst was on Sabbath. Because all I was doing was sitting around doing nothing. I realized that on Sabbath, if I was going to have the best experience on the Sabbath, I needed to do some activity on the Sabbath too. I didn't go to the health club or chop wood or things like that. But you can go for a walk on the Sabbath. Jesus, you know, he was walking. He was physically active on the Sabbath. So even on the Sabbath, I'm not saying you need to do training 7 days a week. You understand the difference? But be active every day of the week. And those of you who've been around from the beginning of the week, we found you have to do hours and hours of exercise each day to get any benefit. Is that true? What is the smallest amount of time that I've been able to find? 6 minutes. The smallest amount of time that gives measurable physical benefits has been proven in the research. 6 minutes of exercise. So before you go to bed tonight, if you haven't gotten in your 6 minutes of exercise, do that. Well, I've done that. I've been walking around the campus. Okay, I know that's more exercise than many of you have gotten for a while. But regular physical exercise, very important for brain health. Very important. Regular exercise actually can also promote cognitive function as we get older. This doesn't prevent dementia. It actually promotes optimal mental health. And if you've had a brain injury, Exercise can actually help improve your recovery. It's not just physical therapy for muscle relearning, if you will, if you've lost some motor function because of a brain injury. It's also good because exercise raises this brain healing compound called BDNF. Now, this is exactly what's going on. As you exercise, levels of this compound are elevated in the brain. And here's a study that says, looked at it in young adults. They found just doing exercise raised BDNF levels about 30%, and the more intense exercise, the greater the rise. Remember, though, if you've not been doing anything, we don't want you trying to see if you can run a marathon tomorrow morning. You understand? That could be fatal. So gradually ease into exercise. If you've got any questions, if you have heart problems or blood pressure issues, check with your physician. Make sure that there's no concern. Did you know, if you want to improve your memory, and remember the name of Mount Sinai Hospital, the changed name, you should be getting more exercise. I've been cutting my exercise back while I've been here. I'm usually out for about an hour in the morning, and I was only out a half an hour today. That must be the explanation. Of course, I'm kidding you. I know it's true about my exercise habits, but that's probably not the reason. Sometimes you can't remember something because you never encoded it in your gray matter to begin with. So just because you heard something doesn't mean you actually paid attention. This is a memory tip for you. The first key to memory is actually getting it in there to begin with. Someone tells you their name, and you didn't really pay attention to their name, there's no way you can remember it. Okay? So it doesn't mean your memory's failing you if you didn't ever record the information. And by the way, since we're speaking about just a few memory tips, if you're cutting yourself short on sleep, sleep is the time where you consolidate memory. I learned this during my years of intemperance, prior to learning all the beauties of the Adventist health message. When I was a college student, I was trying to convince my friend that there was no physiologic need for sleep. I mean, it's amazing how you can think you're intelligent when you're, you know, a young adult and do such crazy things. So I was chronically sleep deprived. In fact, my roommate has terrible memories about something I used to ask him to do. I would deprive myself of sleep. And then I heard about this technique, how to sleep better. You know, a lot of times the box springs are too soft or the bed frame is too soft. So have you heard about putting a piece of plywood between the mattress and the box spring? I heard about that. And I said, you know, I think I could do better than that. I'm going to put the plywood right under my sheet. I'm just letting you know how unbalanced that was. I figured this way I won't sleep too long. It's actually quite hard to sleep all that long on a piece of plywood. But I was so sleep deprived, and I didn't want to sleep much because I had so much studying to do. I told my roommate, I said, wake me up after an hour. And years later, he said, those were the worst memories I have of trying to wake you up. You know, you were so sleep deprived, laying on this board, I couldn't wake you up. You wouldn't get up. I'm telling you that for two reasons. One, if I come down with Alzheimer's or Parkinson's, it may have to do with all that intemperance in my early years. Really, I mean, this is a serious matter. And not getting adequate sleep not only impairs optimal brain health and optimal memory formation, but it actually does take a toll on you long term. I'm telling you all that for another reason, too. And that is because I found I could perform very well on most of my tests. But about a week or two later, I remembered nothing. Okay? So I'd do all this studying, and I could regurgitate all this material on the test and do really well. And the next week, someone said, wasn't that a great class? That was so interesting, that stuff about the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation. And I say, was that one of the students in the class? No, that was the big essay question or something. And, well, I got an A on that. I must have gotten it right. But I actually had no recollection of it.
Well, let's talk a little bit about our friends, the other creatures that God's made, rats. Let me just read this for you. In rats, the stress hormone, corticosterone, seems to decrease the expression of BDNF, and if stress is persistent, this eventually leads to the atrophy of the hippocampus. Hippocampus is a region of the brain that's involved in memory. So even if you're doing the exercise, and you're doing the caloric restriction, and you're watching your lifestyle, if you are under chronic stress, your brain is suffering. This critical brain region for memory is doing what? It's tending to shrivel up instead of thrive. So you may need to focus on stress management as well. And this is just another opportunity to encourage you to think about some of the good programs we have for stress management in the Adventist Church. Have any of you used Skip McCarty's stress management program? Skip is one of the associate pastors at Pioneer Memorial. I see some of you nodding your head. Skip is not only an Adventist pastor, but he's known in stress circles for his work. Dr. Nedley, I've mentioned his depression recovery program. He has a whole evening devoted to the topic of stress and stress management. I've told you about Lifestyle Matters. Have any of you written that down? Lifestyle Matters. That's the Michigan Conference Health Ministries Department. Some of you may know the name of Vicki Griffin or Evelyn Kissinger. But they have a program that deals with optimizing brain performance and things that deal with stress management, addiction, behavior. Living Free is an addiction series. What I'm trying to help you see as we go through these meetings is we've got a bunch of resources out there as a church, and our communities need this material. And by the way, our churches need it too. So how hard would it be when you get a few DVDs, whether you get them here at the book ABC or whether you order them online, and you show this in your church? Would this be such a difficult thing to do? No, it's really not all that difficult. Exercise and stress. Well, here's the good news. Exercise itself helps you deal with stress. And I really appreciated this over the years. After several years of being on an intermittent exercise program, I realized, and I told some of you this before, did you remember what I told you? I realized when I most needed to get exercise. Any of you remember? Yeah, when I thought I had the least time for it. When the day comes when you think you don't have time to exercise that day, that's when you most need it. Because you're feeling so pressured and stressed, and exercise helps to balance the nervous system. If you're sleeping, dozing off and you don't want to doze off, you should exercise. By the way, someone was asking me before the meeting, they said, Dr. DeRose, I really want to hear what you're saying, but I find myself falling asleep. I said, don't feel bad, just get up and back. You see, the young folks, they know how to do this. And you wonder where their energy comes from. It's because they're not sitting down. Maybe that's kind of circular reasoning. But the point is, exercise helps to relieve stress and be active. By the way, you now all have permission to walk back and forth in the back of the auditorium. You see? Isn't that nice? Give you permission to do that. Regular physical exercise, like I said, equalizes the nervous system. If you're depressed, it brings the nervous system up. If you're anxious, it tones things down. So it's just powerful stuff. And exercise also helps to decrease things that contribute to stress in our lives. It will help you with your weight challenges. And many people with chronic illnesses, diabetes, high blood pressure, arthritic conditions, moderate exercise actually helps most of the chronic diseases that we have. Well, let's move on to environmental enrichment or stimulation. Because you've heard a lot about exercise and dietary restriction, and some of you aren't excited. Well, let me tell you now, this is something you can get excited about. Environmental enrichment. Well, what is that? In the research, it looks like this. You take a rat, and you take it out of that sterile environment. You know, it's in that glass cage with the wheel. I mean, how long would that be interesting to you? To be in a little room that had a wheel. Well, it can exercise there. Yeah, and they can exercise, but come on. And you take that rat and now you put it into an area the size of this room with rocks and it can tunnel in there and hide in places. And now you've enriched that rat's environment. Well, what does that look like for humans? How do we enrich our environment? Because what we find when we do that with rats is it actually builds, raises, elevates BDNF levels. So if rats can get this benefit, what do we need to do? Do we need to, you know, stay out in the North Woods? Is that the solution? Well, actually, may make a difference. Well, there's a number of things we can do that are environmentally enriching. One is education. And so that's one of the great things about camp meeting. By the way, just going to another setting is environmentally enriching. Are you aware of that? When you get out of your routine, this is actually challenging your brain. Now, you might be frustrated because you had to wait for the bathroom here, or you know, you had to wait in line for at the cafeteria. But all these things that throw you out of your normal routine are actually enriching to the mind. And we're like, oh no, I forgot my keys, or I can't remember where I put this because you're out of your element. This is actually environmentally enriching. And you ramp it up a level when you start going to classes. And people start telling you things that may be new to you. Or they tell things that are old to you in a different way. So this is environmentally enriching. And how can you continue that at home? What could you do? I mean, camp meeting only comes around once a year. How could you have more environmentally enriching activities in your community? College classes, okay. So you could take a class. If there's a college in your community, you can take a class. How about in your church? I mean, maybe you already have a prayer meeting. Maybe it's really a prayer meeting where you're praying. Or maybe it's like a midweek service where it's more of a class. Well, maybe you could, you know, start attending. Or maybe you could talk with the pastor of your church and say, could we start a health group? You know, once a month, could we have a health meeting? Or could we have a, you know, health night periodically? There's simple things you can do that challenge you and also hold you accountable. You see? We need one another. By the way, you've heard me speak about social support here. We'll end up talking about it more before we finish over the next day or so. But if you combine social connectedness with whatever you're doing, you ramp up your likelihood of success. If you do something on your own, you're much less likely to be successful than if other people are involved. And when you understand that, and you offer a health program in your church, you can freely tell people in the meetings. For example, I have a series on high blood pressure. Some of you were talking with me about it earlier today. And when you go through that series on high blood pressure, we spend considerable time speaking about the value of social support, social connectedness. And I tell the audience, I say, look around you. I mean, you've got a group of people meeting here that are interested in health. Why don't you see if you can still stay connected with them? If you're showing that in the church, what are we telling people? Well, you might be a visitor to the Adventist church, but keep coming back here. Here's a group of people who are interested in health and willing to support one another. So, make a priority of doing things that are environmentally enriching. Do it for your kids. Do it for your grandkids. Help kids in the church. And by the way, it's never too late to start studying a foreign language. This is a very good thing. And the better your linguistic abilities, the less likely your risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. Okay? So you need to resurrect those Norwegian and Swedish and Finnish relatives. Right? I mean, not literally resurrect them, but I mean, you know, resurrect their language skills in your family if you have similar roots to many in this part of the country. Okay, this suggests that you might be able to get further benefit. One of you was saying you missed my speaking about useful work. Well, here's the application of useful work, at least one application in the brain health arena. If you go in the gym and you're exercising, that's good. But you add to your benefits of exercise if you make the exercise in an environment that is environmentally enriched. Just like the treadmill in the cage of the rat
is not a particularly environmentally enriched media or setting, nor is the treadmill in the health club. Okay? I'm not saying don't go to the health club and don't use the treadmill. You understand? That's good. It would be even better if you expended the same amount of energy working outside, chopping wood, mowing the lawn. You say, I don't get any exercise mowing the lawn. If I'm on the treadmill, I'm really running. Well, run with the lawnmower. I mean, I'm joking. I've done that before. It's good exercise that way. What happens once you've done something like that? Well, when you're done in the gym, you look back and the treadmill looks the same, doesn't it? Or you get off your stationary bike. Does anything look different in the room once you've exercised for half an hour? But what happens when you do useful work? You actually have a sense of satisfaction. Look, I split all that wood. Or look at how much nicer the garden looks. Or look, I've planted a new tree. And it's engaging. The mind is more involved. It's much better for stress reduction to do something useful. It actually is building the brain. So get exercise. If you can do something useful, it's even better. If it's outdoors, you're going to get the benefits of fresh air and sunshine, vitamin D. There you go. Well, you might have gathered that alcohol is not good for the brain. So they're telling you to drink it for your heart, and maybe some people are drinking it for their heart because they've drank it long enough that they can't discern some of the other problems with it. It's true. Alcohol has adverse effects on cognitive performance. Alcohol does some interesting things. It actually disrupts a number of these neurotrophins in the brain. And I think I just put this summary slide up here for you, but let's talk about it in a little bit of detail. If you look at what happens to animals, you give them alcohol on a regular basis, it starts to disrupt not only BDNF, but we have other growth factors in the brain. And what happens is, nerve growth factor, one of these other trophic factors, is depressed. BDNF drops in the hippocampus. Who remembers what the hippocampus is involved with? It's involved with memory. This isn't surprising, is it? I mean, what happens to people when they drink? They drink too much, really affects their hippocampus, but even smaller amounts of alcohol are detrimental. So BDNF is very important, but that's not the whole subject when we speak about brain health. And we want to move on and talk about some other areas of lifestyle that can help you optimize cognitive performance, help you deal with stress, and we're going to look through these things. So we're going to talk about fats. Many of you have been anxious that we talk about fats, so we'll talk some about that. We're going to tell you how you can boost your levels of tryptophan and tyrosine in the brain. That will help you make more neurotransmitters. We'll have some cautions about heavy metals and some ideas, things that you can do to protect you. And then we're going to talk about an amazing insight that actually will help connect your community with Bible study in the area of fortifying the brain against traumatic stress. So these are the last topics that we'll cover in the remainder of today and then tomorrow. So let's talk about fat. Fat actually is very interesting when it comes to optimal brain performance. The wrong fat choices actually lie at the root of some of the mental health issues we're dealing with. Some of it relates to stroke, and in fact, we saw others relate to Alzheimer's disease. But let's speak about stroke first because it's so important. There's good evidence that among the things that can help you prevent stroke is a liberal intake of omega-3 fat. You notice here in this particular study, they're talking about fish consumption, as is this study here, and you see that these individuals are being protected from stroke by eating the omega-3 fats from fish. But the first question I have for you is, how effective are fish at making omega-3 fats? How effective are they at making omega-3 fats? I'm impressed by the silence, because you're all correct. Fish cannot make omega-3 fats. All they can do is concentrate it. Omega-3 fat in nature only comes from plant sources. So omega-3 fat is strictly in nature a plant fat. And you do not have to eat fish to get it. But many of the studies have looked at people eating fish because a lot more people in the world eat fish than they do ground flax. Are you aware of that? Well, similar risk protection shown in men as far as stroke protection. Again, this time looking at omega-3 intake, but now these researchers are adding something. Growing evidence that other omega-3 fats, such as alpha-linolenic acid, this is the omega-3 fat found in plant sources, the common plant sources, may offer similar protection. So, whether you're getting it from flax or walnuts or soybeans, the data is suggesting that you are getting a fat that can help you optimize your brain performance and decrease your risk of stroke. This Dutch study just a few years ago, they found if you're not getting much plant omega-3 fat, they're not looking at fish fat, you had a much higher risk of stroke. So plant omega-3 fats are protective from stroke, and we should plan to have these fats. I've been very gratified to see that here in the cafeteria, they serve walnuts with every breakfast. I mean, so far, I mean, maybe I've been talking too much about brain health, and maybe they'll run out. I don't know. But I've seen that's a regular part of the menu here. And if they do that for the kids, that's really great. So other studies show the same thing. And we talked about where omega-3 fats come from. Here's some of the plant sources of omega-3 fats. You can see if we're supplementing omega-3 fat, which we usually don't do. I usually don't prescribe flaxseed oil, except for very certain discrete circumstances. We're usually encouraging people to use the ground flaxseed or walnuts. And I don't recommend canola oil as a dietary supplement. You understand what I'm saying. In other words, don't try to drink canola oil instead of eating walnuts. How many of you have seen posters like this? This is from the Environmental Protection Agency and the FDA. Look what they're saying. What you need to know about mercury in fish and shellfish. Many people are telling us that we should be eating fish, but first of all, this is not a sustainable strategy. There's not enough fish in the world for everyone to get their omega-3s from fish. And many of the fish sources are heavily contaminated, and that's what, there's many warnings. How many of you live near a lake that has signage warning against consumption of too much fish from the lake because of contamination? Any of you see anything? Can I see a few hands? So there are lakes that are even signed. They're that bad. They say you shouldn't eat. I wonder if I didn't put a, I have a picture somewhere of one of these signs, like pregnant women and children should not eat these fish, and you know, healthy men should only have one fish a month. So you're safe then if you just eat one fish a month? But they're like, why would I want to eat those fish? So real concern. And so omega-3 fats help prevent stroke. They also improve blood fluidity, and they also show evidence of helping prevent Alzheimer's disease. So you want to prioritize these fats, these omega-3 healthy plant fats are important for optimal health. Well, we're going to stop there, give you a few minutes for questions and answers. We'll have some more material on fats when we come back, because I know some of you want to expand that discussion a little bit. You've been talking with me about it. So you pray that I make sure. I've got some extra slides that I haven't put in there yet from some other talks that I know some of you would like to see. Any questions as we're winding up? Okay, if you can't eat walnuts and pecans for omega-3 content, flaxseed, ground flax would be the best. Chia seed is another good source of omega-3 fat. And another good nut, just as far as general fat composition, would be almonds. That's another good nut. You have a question too? Oh, Okay, well let's talk. The question is about fluidity of nerve cell membrane. Let me just tell you about that for a minute, and then she had a question about vein size. The neurotransmitters, the brain messengers, interact with the nerve cell membrane. If the nerve cell membrane is stiff or rigid, the nerve transmitters do not work as well. So you want to have a more fluid membrane in order for messaging to take place most effectively. Okay? And you might say, well, this makes some sense. Because, I mean, just conceptualizing it, if something's very rigid, it's hard to interact with it. I'm just trying to help you conceptually understand this. If something's very fluid, maybe I'm not making it easier for you to understand, but this is how it works in physiology. Then our sister asks us the question, well, what about the size of our veins? Does that have any relationship to the nerve cell fluidity? Well, actually, vein size is determined by two things. There are genetic factors that affect it, but also use. If you're using your extremities, the veins will tend to get larger. Actually, having larger veins is beneficial. It's harder for them to clot off, and if they need to give you an IV, they'll have much less problem. People have actually died because they couldn't get an IV in time. So don't ever feel bad, but then you say, Dr. Droz, having big veins really looks bad to me. Well, some of us have to live with it and make the best of it. Question? Okay, so the question has to do with the weight loss equation in different types of milk. So is almond milk a better choice than cow's milk when it comes to weight loss? It does seem to be on one level, and on another level it doesn't. Let me tell you what I'm explaining. If you actually look at the number of calories in the milk, they may not be different. But it's very interesting. One of the things that seems to prevent or make it more difficult to lose weight is called insulin resistance. And animal products tend to worsen insulin resistance. It makes you more likely to have diabetes. It can make it more difficult to lose weight. It can make young women have a harder time getting pregnant, put them at higher risk for polycystic ovary syndrome. I know that's not a concern of yours. But the point is simply this. The almond milk and the soy milk are better choices, but you still can drink too many of those, and many of them, you should read labels, because some of those milks have a lot of sweetener in them. You're better off choosing a lower calorie almond or soy milk with less sweetener. It'll take a little while to get used to, because milk is actually has quite a bit of sugar. Cow's milk has quite a bit of sugar in it. It's not sucrose, it's lactose, the milk sugar, but That's a generally good decision. So you could... Well, if you've got one with zero sugar, you found a good one. Because a lot of them, they add sugar too. I think we have time for one other question. Did I see your hand? Okay, the question is, how do fish concentrate the omega-3 fat? And they actually eat it in their diet. Phytoplankton and other sources are omega-3 sources. In fact, very interestingly, many supplement manufacturers are now turning to these marine algae and phytoplankton as their source for omega-3 fat because they can avoid the problems with mercury. So many of the manufacturers now, many of the supplements that have these longer chain omega-3 fats are actually getting them from these other plant sources in the sea. Okay? Well, we need to wind up. Let's pray together. Father in heaven, thank you so much that we could study together again. Thank you that you've allowed light to shine on our path, how we can preserve our mental capacities and improve them. Please help us to learn these principles and by your grace to put them into practice. Help it make a difference as far as a closer walk with you, a more abundant ministry, a better disposition, as well as a better memory and clearer mind. We ask it all in Jesus' name. Amen.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. International copyright, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage you. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.